Okay, this is Chloe Wardropper. Today is November 3rd, 2016. I'm a student at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and I'm interviewing Kristen Waring. This interview is taking place at the 2016 SAF National Convention in Madison, Wisconsin, at the Monona Terrace Convention Center. It's sponsored by the Society of American Foresters and the University of Wisconsin Oral History Program, and is part of the SAF Oral History Project. So can you say your name and spell your last name, please?
Kristen Waring, W-A-R-I-N-G.
Great, thank you. So to start off, can you tell me the story of how you entered the forestry profession?
Sure. So I grew up in Montana, and it's hard to not be in the outdoors a lot up there. And so I just loved being outside. And so when I went away to college and needed to find a major, forestry seemed like a logical choice. And I didn't know much about the field, but once I got into it, I really enjoyed it and stuck with it. So I declared it at 18 and didn't change majors or anything, which is unusual, given that I'm now a professor. I know how many times the average student changes majors. So that's how I got started.
Great. And then can you tell me a little bit about your career in the forestry profession?
Sure. So I did a Bachelor of Science in Forestry at the University of Montana. And along the way, I got married and had a baby. And so I was a non-traditional student almost immediately. So that made things a little bit more challenging logistically. And so I did a couple of seasonal jobs, but I had to stay relatively close to Missoula and where my family was. And so I decided to stay there for my master's degree. My husband at the time was still an undergraduate student as well. And so I took 1 year off and I worked part-time. I worked a full season with the Forest Service through October, November, and then I did some random jobs. And then I started working back at the university on a graduate project in the silviculture lab for Linda Nagel, who's now a department chair at Colorado State. And she was also married with a child, and so the two of us became really good friends and have been ever since. And so that was my segue back into graduate school the following year when my husband had finished his degree. And so I went back and did my master's. And I pieced it together. We didn't really have a lot of funding for the project. So I taught. I did a couple TA ships and took out some loans. And I had also decided early on that being a college professor was a pretty good fit for me. I wanted to give back in some way. But I'm not patient enough to be a teacher of anyone younger than college. And so I was in line to essentially wanted to go on for a PhD. And so I started exploring those options and ended up going down to the University of California, Berkeley, to pursue my PhD. And didn't take any time off in between those two degrees. So I've really been an academic for a long time, but that's just the way it worked out with being married and having a kid. It's just harder to move around, and you're not quite as flexible. So I did my PhD. I got divorced along the way, so I became a single mom, and then landed a job in Northern Arizona after I did a postdoc, also at Berkeley, because again, you're not that flexible to move around and take short-term jobs. So so I've been at NAU ever since, and it's been a good place to finish raising my daughter, and I've got a good research program and work on silviculture and forest health issues, and I've mixed and matched those for a long time now, so I think it's a good place to be.
Great. How long have you been involved with the Society of American Foresters?
I did not get involved when I was in Montana. I tried. they they didn't have a separate SAF chapter. It was kind of combined with their forestry club, and their forestry club wasn't in line with what I was about in terms of academics and just trying to raise a family. They were much more focused on partying. And they, I went out once and they were not following safety protocol in the field, and trees were being felled very close to other people. And I observed enough things that I had no desire to be involved in any of them anymore. So I went to a couple events and then I just didn't get involved anymore there. But when I got to Cal, I joined the, they had an SAF group and they were much more behaved, I guess. I'm more focused on being professional foresters than undergraduate party mentality. So that was a better fit. And so I've been involved since then, mostly at local. So I've been the chapter chair for our local chapter. I served on the diversity committee at the national level for a while. But I've been really busy, and so a couple of times I've looked at the committees and thought about taking something on, but then didn't feel like I should take anything else on, so.
Great, so this project was developed to understand people's perceptions of diversity and inclusion in the forestry profession. So can you talk about how your cultural background, ethnicity, or gender has influenced your career as a forester?
Sure. So I've been relatively lucky. I think that there hasn't been a lot of gender discrimination. Obviously, being Caucasian, race isn't an issue. But there is one person that I have to interact with regularly who clearly has a gender problem. And I actually think it's not my gender so much as my gender and my role, which puts me professionally sort of above this person. And so he will go to all of my male colleagues, even when I'm the obvious logical choice, and even when my male colleagues say, you need to talk to Kristen. So it's been really, really frustrating, and I can't imagine that happening with all of your colleagues. Given how frustrated I am having to deal with this person over the last several years on a regular basis as just one person. I also find it frustrating that we don't have a lot of female leaders. We are largely a white male crowd still, which is not great for role models for our students. So female students don't tend to stay members after they graduate. And they also see it as a lack of young people, so we just aren't doing a great job of keeping a younger crowd. But without a diverse set of role models, we're not going to get there. I'm involved in a subgroup, the Civil Culture Instructors Tour, a group that when I started going on these tours, there were 5 or 6 females on every tour out of about 50 people, and it's grown. We are... there was at least 10 on the tour I just came from. And they just chose a new leader, and they, rather than going to any one of the females who's been attending for the last 10 to 15 years, they chose another white male to lead. And so I feel like they've missed that opportunity as well, because graduate students come along on that tour, and it would have been nice that it would, and it wasn't a vote, it was just the current leader chose the new leader. So that was a little frustrating for me. It should have maybe at least been a broader discussion of the group of who should be the new leader. So I feel like we have a long ways to go still.
And can you just clarify, what's the Silviculture Instructors Tour?
It is a subgroup of Working Group 2, the Silviculture Working Group within SAF. We're a subgroup of that, and it started out, and it's still, the core group is still people who teach silviculture at universities around the country. And the idea is that whoever is closest to the convention hosts the tour, and we show up a few days early and go see on the ground silviculture being practiced. So it's been an amazing instructor's tool for me. I have photos of here's this on the ground in this forest type and in this forest type, and this is what they're doing now in this, you know, neck of the woods. Mm-hmm. And so it's a really great resource for instructors.
Okay. So you've shared a little bit of this already, but I'm interested in your thoughts about diversity, inclusion, and inclusion in the forestry profession. So since you've talked about that a little bit, you could maybe go more in depth about whether you think, how you see the forestry profession as welcoming new ideas and new people.
Yeah, I think that we have a tendency to not be that welcoming to new ideas. We're fairly conservative for some good reasons. If you're not conservative in forestry, you can make some big mistakes that last a long time. So I think that the roots of being conservative are sound, but we need to be more adaptive to the changing world we're in, and I think that that's part of why we aren't that appealing to younger people. For example, you know, we have these very rigid who can join SAF and how do you define yourself as a forester, and yet all around us the university degree programs are changing and calling themselves different things, and we're excluding a lot of those people just by the sheer nature of the degree that they end up getting within a forestry program. And I think that that's not how we practice forestry anymore. It's a fairly limiting view. So if we could change with that. And there are some factions within SAF that are so tied to that must be a forester to be a part of the group that I haven't talked to anybody who's actually said this, but that if we voted to make it broader, the membership, that they would leave and not be part of the group anymore. That's not very inclusive. So I do think we have a problem with change. and I don't know, that will hopefully slowly change as people retire and you know, new people take over the leadership with different ideas. But it's going to be another decade before that happens, really, I think. So. Mm. I don't know. Did I answer your question?
Yeah, you did. So I'm interested, do you have any thoughts about how your gender influences your work as a forester?
That's an excellent question. because it's very much tied in with my age as well, I think, because I can see some pretty big generational differences, and I have very similar viewpoints as many of my male colleagues. I do think working with students is a little different. I've struggled in the classroom. My voice doesn't project, and so I have to raise my voice so the students in the back of the classroom can hear. And then I get comments like I sound angry and I'm not very nice. And then they'll say, but if you go see her in her office, she's really nice. It's like, I'm not a different person. It's just I have this issue with classroom management that I haven't figured out yet how to get around, just because of my voice. And they are still largely male classrooms. You know, I've got 6 students on average that are women out of 40. And so it's a low percentage of females. And that's been a challenge. With the graduate students, I think I have a really good rapport with them. It's almost all one-on-one, and it's really small classrooms. So regardless of whether it's my own students or a grad class that has a mix of students, I don't have the same issues. So But I don't know if that's tied to my gender or not. Mm-hmm. So,
How do you see SAF as playing a role in increasing diversity and inclusion in the field?
I feel like we are so behind on things like social media and what we've done to make. So there's a diversity reception, but you have to pay for the ticket to go to it. And it's just like all the other receptions. I've been to it. I believe in the diversity program that brings students here, but one of the reasons that I got off that committee was when my term expired and didn't try to re-up, was because I felt like we had started moving away from the diversity focus towards just supporting graduate students who were presenting, who probably already had funding to come present their work. Which is not the point of that program, and I didn't like that. It just seemed really strange, and so I just decided that it wasn't worth pursuing that anymore because I didn't feel like we were supporting the right kind of student. And I don't know where that was almost 10 years ago, so it's probably changed a lot since then. So I don't know now. But that diversity reception, I feel like it should be more open, and you shouldn't have to pay an extra $15 to go. And if you're a student, are you really going to pay an extra $15 to go to that reception? Probably not, if you're on a budget, or however much that reception costs these days. So I think that's a barrier. The whole women thing, I don't know if you've heard about the BABs or whatever they're...
Mm-mm.
Badass bitches or something. Hopefully some woman will show up here and talk about this group who's been involved in it. But it's been really frustrating for me that this is what we do for women in forestry at SAF historically, was this underground BABs or BOBs, but this underground meeting of women that was secret. And you had to run into the right woman who would tell you about it and invite you to, come to the Wisconsin room at 5 o'clock for the BOBS meeting. And it was like a little reception for women. There was snacks and stuff there. But two things. One, you could never plan. So if you schedule, you know, maybe you already have something else going on. And two, what the hell? A secret meeting of women that you have to be able to bump into the right woman in the hallway to get invited to. It's just, I'm still so baffled by that. And so now that I get invited to it on a regular basis, I don't go. I don't want to support that. We should be open. We should be proud that we're women foresters. That's just ridiculous to me. Maybe it worked back when there were 6 women here. But now I feel like it's just, it separates us even more. I don't know. And I'm not the only one that feels that way.
That's really interesting.
It was such a bizarre way to go about it. We don't have a presence on Facebook. So the Wildlife Society has this whole thing, Women of Wildlife. They have buttons and stickers, and they call themselves the WOW group, and they have a Facebook presence, and they link to our cool articles about what women are doing in wildlife, and they promote women in wildlife. And I don't see us doing any of that.
Mm-hmm.
So the whole thing's, we're just not there. There's solutions out there, but I don't know.
Do you see any other organizations, like universities or other organizations in forestry, that are doing more?
Not overtly. Cal likes to talk about how diverse they are because they've had more women than men graduate from their program for years now. And they're also very ethnically diverse. And there are some universities in the Southeast that, you know, are historically black colleges or whatever, and they serve minority populations more. We pay lip service on a lot of campuses in the West to increasing diversity. There's a lot of mostly Caucasian cities and towns in the West still. Our campus in particular increased Native American diversity, and there's no funding to do that. And so it's these unfunded, that's why I kind of say pay lip service to it. Like, yeah, let's go do this, but if you're not going to back it with funds, it's pretty hard to do that. We have a growing Hispanic Native American population, so those two groups are, we see more and more of that in the classroom, which is great. I have two students, I just took them, they volunteered to go help me in the field for a weekend, and two of the four students, their parents are from Mexico. They were both raised in the U.S., but they've had tough lives, and it was really fascinating to hear their stories and spend that much time with them and hear what a struggle it was for them to just get to college. And they're super psyched about forestry, so I was happy to to hear that they're very excited about it, and that it was one male and one female. And it was just some of the challenges that they faced, just even with the woman. Her parents gave her a very traditional Hispanic name that Americans don't pronounce very well. And so I finally asked her how she wanted her name to be pronounced, because I was listening to the undergrad, the other students pronounce it many different ways. And so I just finally was like, you tell us. Mm-hmm. Like, what is the way to pronounce your name, because we're all failing this. And that opened up a whole conversation about how her parents had actually apologized to her recently for giving her this name that Americans don't do very good with. So it's over, even in a pretty white place like Flagstaff, it's the diversity is increasing. Kind of by default, I think we have a pretty big Hispanic, especially the Hispanic population. Our director is currently trying to get a Native American faculty member. We had one in the past who also served as a liaison with the tribes, and to retain, we have a lot of Native American students don't finish, so there's a retention issue, and so having a Native American faculty member mentoring them and just making that group cohesive so that they have a community to rely on seems to help with retention of those students, getting them through. So we're trying to get that position back funded again. So
are there any other things that you think SAF or other institutions should do to increase diversity?
I think this goes back to sort of the idea that we're a little resistant to change. We still have these fairly academic-ish meetings. The local chapter meetings feel very much like we hold ours in a classroom, and we always have a speaker. And some of the professionals are just like, I'm not interested. You know, if it was something less formal and felt less like going back to school, being lectured at, maybe I would, you know, be more interested. And we all voted at one point that, you know, maybe a couple times a year we would meet at a local bar for like a happy hour and maybe distribute some local news item that was related to forestry and have everybody read it ahead of time. Go to this informal setting early in the day so that students could come and, you know, encourage people to mingle and talk about these ideas. And then we never did it. And I asked the chair, why didn't we ever implement that? And he said, well, you know, some of the people just didn't want to do that. So, okay. But most people voted that they did want to do that. So again, it's just that resistance to change. Well, we're in the classroom, and it's easy to hold it in the classroom, and so we'll just keep, darn it, holding it in the classroom. So that's an issue. I specifically asked a young female professional in our area what would keep her coming to SAF? And she said, we need more young people in SAF. And I said, that means you have to stay a member. and then we'll grow it. Because if you all leave, then we don't have any young to build on. And if you want other young people in it, then... So there's a catch-22 there. How do you get them to stay? And it's, you got to diversify what you're offering and make it more fun, I think. And that, especially young people, their attention span is all over the place. And so something like that bar setting where you're interacting and you can move around and talk to different people, and they're not just sitting in the classroom for an hour listening to somebody talk, and you don't get to really interact with the people there. And by the time it's over, everybody just wants to go home, you know. So, yeah.
Great, thank you. Okay, this is a big question. Where do you see the profession of forestry going in the next 20 years and 100 years?
Oh, that is a big question. Oh, wow. Where is it going? So, oh, wow, that is such a good question. In 100 years, I think that that's really pie in the sky.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Places like the Southwest might not even have trees. So there's no need for forestry if you don't have trees. But at some point when all the trees start dying, people will realize they want trees in the landscape, and so we might end up planting non-native things out there that can handle hotter, drier conditions. It'll be fascinating to see how that plays out. But people like trees, so 20 years from now, I mean, the change is so incremental in forestry. There's a growing shift toward more restoration type objectives. Southwest has been there for a long time. California's sort of moving that way. The Southeast is to some extent. The Northwest has a push that way. So that seems like a trend that's going to keep growing. And if SAF doesn't shift, I think it'll die. I mean, it's the membership just keeps going down, and we're a largely older crowd. So if we can't fix this problem, we're not going to be relevant. And so it's not a sustainable structure. But everybody knows that. You look at the membership graphs. Silviculturists know that really well. You don't have the young to replace the old. You're not non-sustainable. So that's kind of bleak. That was depressing. But it all ties back together, you know. And so we've got these things like climate change and invasive species and the restoration type movement, and you just can't have a narrowly defined field to tackle those huge problems. And so we've got to broaden how we think about who we are and what it means to be a member of this group, and how we brand what forestry really is, or we'll cease to be relevant.
Great. Well, I have a few other questions that are kind of additional questions. It's been about half an hour. Do you mind if I go ahead?
Go for it.
Okay. So you might have touched on this a little bit, but how would you say the profession of forestry has changed throughout your career?
Changed. The loss of the timber industry has been huge, and that's really helped push the restoration type objectives and thinking more creatively about how we're going to deal with small diameter trees when we have too many, and that's local to some you know, well, not local, I guess it's regional, the whole West. But then I was just on this tour in the Lake States, and some of the ecosystems here are also suffering from lack of fire, and so similar issues. So if you don't have a strong timber market, how else do you figure out how to manage the trees? So I think that's been a pretty big shift. And then invasive species and climate change. Nobody was really talking about them 20 years ago. Invasive species, to some extent, we've been talking about for 100 years or more for some trees, but it's just the eastern forests, they're not the same. There are so many invasive species out there. The ecosystem's just different. And at some point, it'll reach a tipping point. And so, I think those are probably the biggest changes. Like, we actually teach climate change, teach about invasive species. 10 years ago, it wasn't really okay to add climate change in. It was okay to talk about invasive species. And now it's something that we expect to talk about. In every class, we mention climate change and how it's going to affect that particular part of the class or the whole subject. So I think it's been a sea change of acceptance.
What has been the most rewarding aspect of your career?
My graduate students. It's really fun to work with them, see them develop as a forestry professional, and then go off and get jobs as forestry professionals, and know that I'm training good silviculturists who are actually out there making a difference in the landscape. And that extends to the undergrads as well, to some extent, although fewer of them come back and say, oh yeah, you know, thanks for teaching me silviculture. Some of them do. But the graduate students, there's a much more direct connection there. So I really enjoy the graduate student component of what I do.
Great. What have been the biggest challenges in your career?
Being a single parent on the tenure track. That was challenging. I think that whole work-life balance is a challenge, and I think we're all struggling with that. Even now that my daughter's grown, I struggle with that. The universities expect more from us, because even at a teaching institution now, they're requiring more research or expecting more research, and so your teaching load stays the same, and you add all these additional, like, oh, I gotta go get the grants and write the papers and do it all quickly, and it just is adding a lot of stress, and so I think we're going to see more people either not choose to go into academia or because they've heard these stories. And if we're honest with our grad students, we tell them, or they watch us, or leave and take other positions after several years because they can't find that balance. So I know a few people have already done that, and I finished one PhD student, and we talked a lot about careers, and she didn't want to be an academic when she finished, and she's with the Forest Service and really happy. So I think that's specifically an academic challenge, but I know a lot of Forest Service people who have too much work on their plates too. They are at least not expected to take it home with them.
Yeah. Can you think of a specific person who helped you along the way?
Yeah, so there have been a few. Linda Nagel has been an amazing friend and mentor over the years. She's an incredibly calm person, and there's a reason she's the department head now. So it's been nice to have somebody who remarkably similar career path and trajectory, and with the fact that we were both married really young and had kids, and so that's been very helpful. And then Kevin O'Hara, my PhD advisor, I was just talking to a current student of his who's a single mom, and we chatted about how he's always been open to that. And I know when I was a grad student, I took my daughter with me everywhere, field trips and into meetings in his office and into classrooms, and and he was fine with all of that as long as she was well behaved, which, you know, I made sure she was. But so without people giving you a helping hand along the way, and being open to different lifestyles, you know, I wouldn't be here today without that. So I think that's pretty critical.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And finally, what advice would you give a student or a new forester just starting off? I know you give this advice all the time, so it must be at the tip of your tongue.
Two things, you know, make sure they find balance. Don't take on too much. And try to stay in the moment and enjoy their career and their families, because it's gone before you know it. So, you know, if you work every Saturday and Sunday, your kids are going to grow up and you're going to miss it. And you're going to turn around and say, I wish I'd, you know, did you really get that much further ahead because you were working Saturday and Sunday? The answer is going to be no. So stay in the moment, balance your life.
Mm-hmm. Great, thank you. So to finish up, we have a few demographic questions. What year were you born?
1975.
Okay. And what gender do you identify as?
Female.
And what is your ethnic, racial, or cultural background?
Caucasian.
Okay. Anything you'd like to add about forestry or SAF or diversity that we didn't cover?
No, I'm really glad you're doing this project. I'm excited to hear how it turns out. Thanks for the opportunity.
Thank you. All right, I'll turn off the recorder now.